They entered very slowly, shining their flash beams forward. Rock moved the beam of his flashlight to the walls and ceilings.
You get a real feel for how well made this place is. Spooky.
In no time at all, they came to a dead end and found no way to go any further. Rock hesitated to blast with Detroit's grenades, and they continued to search for a way beyond the barrier of stone. Archer grew tired and leaned his big hulk against the smooth gray block wall. Then Archer was gone. Chen went over to look at the place they last saw him.
A swivel door. Archer is inside and we're outside.
Archer came around again, and this time Rock caught the door's edge, arresting its movement. The group entered the surprisingly well-lit interior.
No one except you could have found it, Arch. You're smart as hell, ain't you?
Smart? Oh, yeah, me smart!
The corridor was long, and it bent upward, though not steeply. There were no steps or railings, no decorations, just gray, smooth walls. Then there was another door. Roxon pressed against the surprisingly earth-like ornament of eagles on trees embossed on the door. When he touched a tongue of one of the eagles, the door moved. On the other side of the door was a vast chamber. Here, sunlight came down in a hazy shaft from high above, and many box-like structures, yards high, lay beneath inches of dust. The dust of eons. The place was the size of 6 cathedrals.
Might as well step in.
Rock didn't like the look of 2 griffin statues on either side of the portal. Griffins, Roxon remembered, ate only virgins. None of his men qualified. Still, the monkey-faced, heavily fanged, winged lion creatures had an ominous presence. The stone gargoyles seemed to be watching Roxon. This feeling of being watched was, he decided, the effect of the richly oxygenated air of the asteroid. Still, caution was the word.
Shot pistols out. Detroit, pull a grenade. We go in slowly.
They moved in about 10 feet, making deep footprints in the dust. Everything was silent. Suddenly, a ray of brilliant white shot out of the mouth of the griffin on the left. Harper and Williams were dead in one brilliant flash. Detroit managed to avoid a direct hit, but he did get a searing burn on his forearm. Both griffins now inexplicably faced the remaining free fighters.
Take the damn thing out! It's over!
The Doomsday Warrior went over to the piles of ashes that were his loyal friends.
I blame myself. I should have been more careful.
Or maybe you should have said that you are entering the Temple of Mu in peace.
The group spun around, and their visitor was walking toward them. But she wasn't solid. The beautiful apparition had a semi-transparent quality. Rock stood, jaw open, utterly flabbergasted. He stared wide-eyed at someone he knew. A robed human figure. Long, blonde hair, flawless complexion. The spitting image of the saintly angel he knew as Pruzak. She was floating over the floor, a few inches above it.
Roxon, is it a ghost?
I am not a ghost. I am a friend of Roxon.
Yes, we know each other. I met her at the Glower's settlement. You don't have to fear.
But she's not a real person.
Roxon is right. Besides, I'm not vulnerable to bullets. It would be easier to converse if you could all hold your fire. Please, there is no more harm coming to you now. I cannot be held responsible for the Guardian's actions. None of you spoke to them of your intentions. The Guardians of Mu were automatic. They were meant to destroy not humans, but others. They were meant to destroy evil things. It is too long a story for now. Suffice it to say that we, the Korakans, that is, expected a visit by such evil ones. The Guardians were a reasonable precaution. Several times in the past, non-human races have attempted to enter this pyramid, to steal the knowledge of the Neurodancer. That is forbidden by the Old Ones, for this place is for humans only. No other may plumb its secrets or absorb its powers. The Neurodancer is the final creation of the asteroid dwellers, a living machine. It is a link that allows the daring one attached to it to create what one thinks. It can give ultimate knowledge or ultimate power. You choose.
Rock moved forward warily and stuck his hand through Pruzak's robe.
Nothing. Just thin air. Are you a projection? Are you here?
Yes and no. I am dead, and this place is dead. I walk between the worlds. Do you not remember our communion? I came to warn you that the Guardians would be activated when you came into the chamber of the Neurodancer. I came too late.
Never mind. Can you bring back our friends? Can you undo what has happened to us?
I am sorry to say the rays are real, though I am like to a specter. Your friends have joined the universe as particles, but I can mend your arm.
Wow. It doesn't even hurt anymore. You're a real angel.
I will be your guide to protect you, but I am not an angel. I can make mistakes. I can understand the use of the equipment here. What is it you wish to access, Roxanne?
Roxanne had many questions for her, but every second of delay meant the Earth was moving past the asteroid. He didn't know the range of the saucer, but the sooner he got what he came for, the better. Rock was stunned by that thought. What had he come here for? The answer was
destiny.
Yes, I understand. I will show you. There is urgency. You must take a message, take an understanding back to Earth. Without this knowledge, Earth will soon be destroyed. Not by any asteroid, but by ignorance. I must immediately show you the Neurodancer. You will become one with it and engage the circuits to bring the knowledge in you up to full power. Come quickly. It is no little thing to become a person of knowledge.
Don't go. I know trust ghosts.
It'll be all right, and she's right. I know it is necessary.
As Rock moved along with Pruzak, all the giant square constructions about the immense chamber began coming alive. Rock could sense the very air becoming charged with a presence. It was the Neurodancer. Everything, the whole place. Pruzak led him up to a dais, one like an altar in a church. He was standing before a strange, peaceful-looking statue. A statue of a seated blue granite man. The face of the man was like Buddha, but the body was that of a pharaoh.
The center of power.
Rock was directed up a side stair by Pruzak.
Roxanne, sit in his lap.
Roxanne sat. Then a whirring, and Rock felt a great exaltation. He was to be raised. He wished it. Tentacles had issued from the statue, and these living lines of power touched him tenderly, wrapped about his head. Yet he feared not. It was necessary.
These are the neural attachments for your brain. There will be slight pain, but it is harmless. The Neurodancer will attach to your skull, go inside your head, and link up. You will be able to interact with the Neurodancer by direct thought. Guard yourself from stray thoughts. Concentrate on finding out what is necessary to save the Earth.
Roxanne let it happen. He let the million tiny tentacles enter him. Slowly, almost painlessly, the world disappeared.
I don't like it. Rock looks dead.
He's not dead.
There were 1,000 or more tiny pinpricks all over the Doomsday Warrior's face and skull. Some bled slightly, but he breathed. Breathed beneath a mass of throbbing, slimy threads that had entered his head. It had been an hour since Roxanne had been led away by Pruzak. Roxanne had been attached to the Neurodancer, some sort of machine or computer inside the huge statue. This much Detroit knew because Pruzak had told him so before she disappeared. But what would happen now? Detroit wasn't at all sure. Had Roxanne found out the secret of mankind's survival? Would he now understand what had to be done to save the Earth? Could he articulate that secret? Would he survive? The Doomsday Warrior was coming around. He twitched violently in the lap seat of the Stone Pharaoh. Then, his eyes opened.
Roxanne, you okay?
To Roxanne, it was an absurd question. He'd been in another reality, a place where okay and not okay were meaningless concepts. He'd undergone a conscious expansion wider than any that could have been induced by drugs or any other means. This experience had been even more powerful than his communion with Pruzak back in the Glower's tent. He was now a million times smarter than before. His memory went back a billion years. Roxanne came to know all this in short flashes, flashes of understanding that stunned him, yet were easy to accept.
Yes, I'm fine. But the world is sick. Earth is sick.
Rox stood up unsteadily. His friends helped him down from the statue.
Please, get me out of the pyramid.
Only when he and his remaining men were out on the pink-tinted surface did he speak. His words were strange.
Here is the knowledge. Here is the message that could, if anyone listens, save the Earth. Mankind has gained victory over medieval superstitions. Science has cast away natural philosophy and refused to use the way of thinking based on any embracing vision. The deductive method gave way to the inductive method of gathering facts and formulating theories. In this way, Earth's people have denied vision-based methods and concepts and all considerations of purpose or right or beauty. Because thought lacked a scientific basis, religious and ethical ideals were undermined. Science triumphantly progressed from success to greater success. Steam, electricity, radio, lasers, nukes, rockets, genetic engineering. By the 21st century, it was clear that this development was fraught with unpleasant consequences. The unimpeded progress of science became a threat to mankind's survival. Scientific knowledge brought about a loss of orientation. It explained what and how, but it did not explain why and for what purpose. It claimed these questions weren't scientific. The continuing accumulation of knowledge without purpose leaves vital aspirations unfulfilled. The profound need to know who we are, to know our origin, fulfillment, and the nature of reality. That is the crisis. We must bring science's logic and methodology into accord with layers of reality lying so deep that they cannot be contacted by the ordinary senses. We must attempt to restore well-forgotten concepts such as purpose, wholeness, aliveness, and the hidden order of the universe. There is a way to do this. One of the characteristics of thought is its power. This power draws us, holding us captive. The aim of the Neurodancer is to open the world of thoughts. I directly experienced the field, the energy, and the content of thoughts, and I opened all these aspects. I was no longer blindly participating in the world of the mind. This is real freedom and strength, for I know now that we are not bound to suffering and trapped by emotionality. We can overcome, don't you see? Opening the world of thought does not depend on a Neurodancer, but on direct experience. If I can communicate with my own mind, I can open thoughts through thoughts. The starting point is to see that we are not free, that we are trapped in the field of emotions and thoughts. The more deeply I understand this, the more easily I can cut through the bonds that restrict. The easier this cutting through becomes, the deeper my understanding grows. Eventually, I can directly touch the meaning of knowledge, finding the source of it, and true meaning and value. I will explain this all mathematically to Schechter and to other great thinkers.
I could sure use a cigarette, but I don't smoke. I didn't understand a word you said, but I want to. We all want to understand.
And you will.
But there was a blackness in his stare, and the pinprick incisions on his forehead oozed blood. He didn't look well. He looked like a man who'd seen far too much. At that instant, on the other side of the asteroid, Keyloth and his Japanese manservant, Tekamaki, were making the final approach for a crash landing.
Impact in 20 seconds!
Keyloth pulled the lever that shot the last of the power to slow them. The speed indicator dropped from 700 kilometers per hour to just over 70 kilometers per hour. Perhaps he would not make it this time, Keyloth admitted to himself.
Curse you, Roxanne! Curse you to hell!
Quickly, Tekamaki! I smell fire. We must get out!
Master, you are the greatest pilot in the universe!
Yes, I am, but hurry! Get me out of here! Now!
In a matter of moments, they were clambering up the sand dune that was spilling into the wreckage of the burning spacecraft. They scrambled across the surface until they were well away from the wreck.
Nice air. Just like the ancient records promised. Tekamaki, smell the air. How sweet it is to be alive. We have done it. We live. I live to destroy Ted Roxon. I see my destiny now. It is plotted out before me. The Dark One has answered me. I will use the weapons on this asteroid to blast Earth to bits. Somehow, by some trick, Roxon has diverted this world from the collision course. But you and I, Tekamaki, you and I will destroy Earth. We will be the last human beings alive in the whole solar system. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes, Master.
Keyloth pulled a singed map out of his pocket. The map of the asteroid that had been found in the Incan records in Machu Picchu. He and his Japanese manservant started walking overland toward the pyramid storehouse, the place the ancient records promised held all the powers of the universe and all the weapons any man could dream of. The trek wasn't arduous, for Keyloth was assisted by the drugs he'd shot into his veins. That and the low gravity. And Tekamaki was an accomplished hiker. They would be there in 10 minutes. Unknown to Keyloth, Roxon and the surviving members of the American crew were at that moment moving in the opposite direction, leaving the pyramid to head back to their space saucer. Their paths were bound to cross. But not yet. The Dark One had a present for his dear one, Keyloth.
Rock, you all right?
Fine. There's no time to waste. Let's get back into the saucer and make the return trip.
Yet the minute Roxon moved, he sagged. His legs were like rubber.
Rock, are you sure you're all right? Do you want us to carry you?
Roxon pushed McCaughlin away. He looked strange. McCaughlin and Chen helped Roxon to a sitting position on a mound of gravelly sand as the others looked on with concern.
Nothing to win, nothing to lose, nothing to practice, nothing to prove. All is illusion. Why grasp at illusion?
Has he gone mad? What the hell do we do?
Suddenly, there was a glow in the sky, and that blue-white glow coalesced into a form. It was Pruzak again. She appeared over the sands like an angel, semi-transparent, with the earth shining right through her.
Let him rest. It is necessary that he step down mentally from the charge of knowledge that he was subjected to in the Neurodancer. The Neurodancer has given him too much information. Roxon must spill out some of it. He's absorbed too much for any Earthman. Let him be. Let him recover. He will remember what he needs to know to tell your people of Earth after arrest.
Detroit looked at the blue-white Earth above. It wasn't growing larger anymore. Instead, it was starting to move closer to the horizon. The asteroid they were standing on, propelled by the geyser of gas unleashed by the nuclear explosion, was now moving past the Earth with ever-increasing velocity. They could be marooned.
Pruzak, we must get going as soon as possible. Can't we just get him to the ship and let this spilling occur on the way back to Earth?
No. He would be unable to fly the saucer for at least the next hour. None of you understands how to fly it.
Pruzak's right. I never flew it. I just worked the power switches on the drive. We have to have Rock alert and capable in order to take off.
Walk him around slowly. Keep Roxen moving. He will say things, some of which you might care to listen to and remember. Some of what he says will be gibberish to you all. When his speech slows down and the glassy-eyed look fades, Roxen will be well enough to pilot your spacecraft. Now I must go back to the world of the dead.
They did as the ghostly Pruzak had asked, started walking Roxen around, supporting him on their shoulders.
I don't like this. When does Rock start all this dumping of knowledge? He's silent as a...
Then words started pouring out of Roxen's mouth. He spoke of philosophy, religion, politics, and everything between. Roxen was soon going on about some belief called Krook, the religion of a world known as Talus 12. Only snatches of it were caught by Chen's ears, but he had the cassette mic pinned near Rock's lapel. The recorder would get it all. Then came a burst of talk about the religion Tukil, an early Earth religion, dead long before the last ice age. It was a religion centered on bears. Then Roxen spouted formulas that were the derivations of a religion of pure mathematics on Orion Alpha 7. His words were in English, and the identification of these words were in human terms. The asteroid apparently had roamed far and wide in the universe. The Karakans had visited many worlds, probably never returning to them. The immensity of the knowledge stored in the Neurodancer became evident to them all when they realized this.
Imagine! A billion or more years of interstellar travel. No wonder that accumulated knowledge was too much for Roxen to stand. Chen, you sure you're getting all this on the recorder? Is it working?
Yes, it's turning at least. I hope to God it works well enough. The recorder took lots of bangs on the way here.
And the consistent forces would tear apart the Earth-space continuum. Oh, hi. What's up?
Rock, are you all right?
Sure, I guess so. Where? Oh, now I remember. I was in the Neurodancer. I learned... Yes, I still remember it. I have a message for Earth. What are we walking around in circles for? We have to get to the saucer. Let's go!
Chen smiled, snapped the mic off Roxen's lapel, and attaching it to his recorder, shoved the recorder into his belt pack.
I'll explain that later.
Rock took the lead as they rushed for the saucer. Kilof and Tekamaki, meanwhile, were walking in a path that would intersect with Roxen and his men in a matter of minutes. Kilof stepped rapidly over the pink sands, moving toward the rough, pyramid-shaped mountain, half obscured by a dune ahead. Tekamaki scrambled on his short legs to keep up. His master was eager to get to his goal. Because of their haste, Kilof didn't notice several objects half buried in the sand that he and his servant traversed. That is, he didn't notice until he stumbled on one of them. As Kilof rose, he saw a dull metallic gleam.
What the?
Kilof dug the object from the sands, picking it up. It was a sculpted piece of dully gleaming black metal, incredibly light to the touch. It was a seven-pointed star, about a foot wide. Kilof's mind clicked. He remembered a dream he'd had in Peru. Yes, this object was the power thing that he'd seen in his dream. It had to be.
Master, what are you doing? No time for souvenirs. You said we
must... Shut up, Tekamaki. This thing is a power of some sort. It is a weapon. I sense that. So lovely, so powerful.
How does it work, Master?
I can't remember, but it was in my dream. It seemed easy to use in my dream. We'll take it along with us to the pyramid. Perhaps I'll remember on the way there. Or maybe the neural dancer can tell me how to use it.
The KGB leader zipped the object into his black leather jacket and again rushed toward the pyramid with Takamaki following. At the top of a rolling dune, the pair were suddenly face to face with a party of Earthlings who were coming up the other side of the dune.
Kilo.
Roxanne.
What the hell?
Keyloth, who had been shrinking and wincing, expecting an ignominious end, for he had no weapon, now stood up and smiled. Keyloth understood now. He remembered his dream about the black star-shaped metal object. This was the weapon he held. It had no trigger, it had no mechanism, but it responded to the wishes of its owner. The black star was a thought weapon. It could manipulate matter with the mind. Keyloth had hoped against hope that the weapon of his enemies wouldn't fire, and they hadn't. It was the hope that had activated the Black Star. He'd be quick to capitalize on this fortunate event.
Now it's time for some fun.
What is this? Magic? Well, maybe magic doesn't work against my weapons.
And despite Keyloth's desire for the dart to disappear, it didn't.
Master, no!
Keyloth thought of his loss for a mere instant, then decided he'd better do something fast before another dart was unleashed. Evidently, the Black Star thought weapon worked only against mechanical objects, guns and such. It could manipulate the mechanical weapons, move them.
That's it! I command all those guns and the people attached to them to be blown away! Away with Roxanne's men! But not Rock! He stays. It will be I against Roxanne. I will it! I am the most powerful warrior the Ancient Ones of this world ever knew! So be it!
When the wind stopped, Roxanne faced his opponent alone. All Roxanne's men and the body of Takamaki were gone from the scene. Keyloth still stood there, however. But Keyloth was transformed. The KGB leader was barely recognizable. For one thing, there was the matter of his size. He'd been an emaciated figure of a man, stringy, almost skeletal. Now Keyloth was a muscular, 9-foot-tall creature. In place of his 2 beady dark eyes were 3 bright yellow ones, like an awful nightmare. Somehow Roxanne could still recognize, in that drooling, green-skinned alien creature's face, the essential features of Keyloth. There was no mistaking that voice from the bony-ridged lips of the monster.
You see, Roxanne, you see now how strong I am. Do you realize how much fun I will have killing you? This is the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me. You should feel the power. The immense speed of this new body of mine. I have become Mu-Ten, the great warrior. Prepare to die, puny one.
Roxanne looked it over for a weak spot. It had clawed hands and feet, folds of armor-like bones, and flaps of steel-hard skin all over its lizard-like body. Its muscles flickered with energy. He didn't see anything he could call weak. Roxanne took a step back, involuntarily. Keyloth moved forward slowly.
Yes, Roxanne, a miracle, is it not? By merely wishing so, I am an invincible fighter. I am Mu-Ten, champion of old. Now you die in a most horrible way.
Roxanne had no time to think about it. The 9-foot-tall horror was coming at him, trying to back him against a dune.
I will amuse myself. You will not die so fast like Takamaki did. Oh no, not that easy.
Fuck you.
Nothing. Mu-Ten smiled.
Time to die, Roxanne. But you die slowly. Slowly. I let your gun fire this time to show you my strength.
Yeah! Rock threw the gun down and dived towards something he saw jammed into the sand a few feet away. He grabbed the handle. It was a heavy pick-like thing. Rock hefted the big pick in his hand. Mu-Ten just stood there, waiting.
Enough, Roxanne. You cannot beat me. No human can. Do you not understand?
The blow did little damage to the monster. The best Roxxon was able to do was keep the thing off balance. Every time Mutem reached for Roxxon, the Doomsday Warrior dodged back a step and then pushed in again.
I will squeeze you into pulp.
Mutem reached forward with incredible speed and caught Roxxon's left shoulder. The pick slipped from his fingers. Roxxon didn't care. The pain searing through his shoulder was too immediate, too real to allow him to worry about anything else.
Shall I kill you now, Roxxon?
Maybe. And maybe not just fucking yet, you bastard!
Rock hooked his left foot behind the Keloff thing's right and jerked with all his remaining strength, pulling the monster man's foot across the sands, causing him to lose his balance. The pair teetered for a second, then went crashing down. The instant Mutem fell, Rock pulled away, rolling across the ground. Rock dived across the sands, sliding to the ancient pick and grabbing it with his right hand. Roxxon swung his pick and drove it into Mutem's right knee joint with all the force he had.
Yeah, gotcha, you KGB bastard. It's time for the monster mash.
The pick had torn half a dozen of the monster's joints, but though damaged, Mutem stood up. No joint had broken, unfortunately. Mutem moved forward solidly, swiftly, his one good arm reaching, searching under those cold yellow triple eyes. Roxxon stepped back, but could not dodge the running onslaught of the monster. Rock tried again to bring the pick to bear on his foe, but it was torn from his hands.
This was your only hope. Now, you have no hope, Roxxon.
Reaching out, Mutem caught hold of Roxxon's previously injured shoulder and again squeezed.
Yes! I kill you now, Roxxon! You die in an alien world!
The thing dropped him at its feet.
No! Also, you cry out like a baby. I like that. Such a pitiful human thing. You lay in the dirt screaming with your eyes filled with tears, and now I stomp your lap bug.
With his last energy, Roxxon wildly rolled to the side. Mutem's metallic foot stomped the ground where Roxxon's head had been. Rock's searching hand found the cable. He gripped the cable in both hands and, ignoring the pain, got into a crouch and pulled, freeing it from the sand to find a heavy metal ball dangling at the end of it. Grinning, Roxxon staggered to his feet, starting to swing the cable with ball over his head.
Okay, now for one more round.
The KGB man thing twisted from the impact. Then the thing reached out and caught the end of the cable with his good hand. Roxxon was instantly jerked from his feet.
Roxxon? Roxxon?
Rock lay still, not able to move. He had escaped the thing's grasp only to find he could do little more than crawl. He waited for the moment when Mutem would end his life. Perhaps the monster man would kick him to death or crush his head in his clawed hand. This was it. But Keloff walked right by him. He couldn't see Rock. He'd severely damaged his eyes, Roxxon realized. Roxxon got to his feet silently, keeping his eyes on Mutem. The man-thing turned inadvertently, showing his foe what had happened. The ball had crushed the shield bones over Mutem's eyes. Although he was able to guide himself slightly with his blurred sight, he could not distinguish one immobile object from another. Roxxon carefully moved away, hoping the movement wouldn't be caught. There was a small pillar. The thing's head tilted up when Roxxon dislodged something. It started climbing, sure-footed, swiftly. Rock was some 30 feet above the monster man. He looked in vain for some wet the benevolent sands might yield up to him as before. The only thing he had left to throw at Mutem was his own body. Where should he aim his steel-heeled boots? Then he had it. In a flash, Mutem had human arrogance, human cruelty. He had a human brain. And a brain is connected to a body by a spine at the back of the neck. Bracing himself, Roxanne tried to judge the distance between himself and Keyloth, then hurtled downward at his foe, feet first. Something happened. Keyloth's mouth opened, but made no sound. He jerked his good arm, thrashing around, uncontrolled. Rock looked back at the teetering giant, expecting him to turn and finish him finally. But a gush of red shot from the back of Mutem's head onto the pink sand. Keyloth jerked wildly and slowly toppled to the ground. Mutem could be defeated and probably even killed. He looked dead, but was he? Rock went to get the discarded pick, intending to smash the monster's head in for good measure. He returned in just an instant, but Keyloth was gone without a trace. Keyloth had wished he was away from Roxanne, and it had happened, just like that. But where was he? Keyloth sat smack in the lap of the granite statue. There were tendrils like thin, glistening snakes, hundreds of them coming from the stomach of the statue. The snaking tendrils moved as if they were seeking something. With ultimate terror, Keyloth realized they were seeking him. The KGB-er shook and whimpered in terror, paralyzed by the touch of one of the leading tendrils. A feeling of rushing into vast space overwhelmed him. The other tendrils attached, one by one, twisting into him like hot needles. They pierced his scalp, jammed up his nose, crawled along the veins in his temples. They were wiring him to the great machine. The living machine's tendrils tore through his neck and rapidly slid up his veins into his cortex. He should have died, and yet he lived. Lived, and more than that, Keyloth's mind had suddenly expanded. And more than expanded, it was integrated into a vast whole, a mind-machine symbiotic interface that defied explanation. Frightened, yet curious, Keyloth moved his mind into the vaster energy field of ultimate thought knowledge. He adjusted his hands on his lap like an obedient student. Then the mind of Keyloth alternated between a clashing, jarring, loud willing of power to soft, mellow passages of thought movement. Keyloth could only understand what he was doing in the vast thought energy field by thinking of himself as the most powerful demon in the universe.
I am Satan, and my will be done!
Under his control now, the Neurodancer was showing Keyloth what powerful weapons were at his disposal, letting him select a vision. Keyloth saw things he could not believe. Even the Dark One himself could not have imagined such things. The machine was flashing pictures in his mind of a weapon to destroy planets. It was a matter manipulator, a neutrino blaster. The ancient inhabitants of the asteroid stored all they knew in the Neurodancer. Keyloth could have learned so much of art, philosophy, and religion, but he cared not for knowledge. He cared only for power, for the ultimate weapon. The killer mind directed his will one way, to activate the ancient maximum weapon. Fate would have it that he would be the one to destroy Earth. Gears clanked, ancient systems came alive. Linked to the ultimate mind of the Neurodancer, Keyloth summoned the neutrino blaster, willed it to activate.
Thy will be done.
The deadly neutrino blaster, an antimatter world-destroying gun, was a complex device, and only a mind-machine integration could fathom its use. The 500-foot-high world destroyer gun came erupting up like a demon out of its age-old hiding place in the floor of the pyramid. When the dust cleared, the sky could be seen above, a sky filled with the earth. Keyloth turned his mad, bloodshot eyes upward to see his target. He started to line up the weapon for firing.
Thy will be done!
Roxanne heard the thunderous noise of the pyramid being torn asunder as he was searching the desert for his men. Keyloth had evaporated. Intuitively, Roxanne understood. It could only be Keyloth. He'd reached the Neurodancer. Roxxon staggered back toward the vast temple. He entered and saw the roof caved in, a vast cloud of debris. Rock rushed on and found Keyloth on the statue, his skull woven into the neurodancer's tendrils. But that was not all. The center of the blasted open pyramid held a giant space gun, which pointed toward Earth. This was the most powerful weapon ever created, Roxxon knew. A world destroyer, emerging from the clouds of dust. Roxxon rushed to stop Keyloth, but a force field bounced him away painfully. Roxxon got up and steeled his mutant strength. He had to get Keyloth and stop him, no matter what. Rock charged forward again and broke through the force field. He tore at Keyloth, but it was too late. Keyloth had managed to fire the huge planet destroyer weapon even as Rock's fingers touched his enemy's vulnerable, scrawny human neck. The madman's black, feral eyes gleamed in victory. Rock let go of Keyloth's throat for a moment and watched the weapon's death beam shoot out into the sky. It spread up, heading inexorably toward Earth at thousands of miles per hour.
In a few minutes, Earth will be gone. And nothing can stop that from happening.
If it's the end of the world you want, you'll not live to see it.
And then the beam of death headed toward Earth just evaporated. The Earth was not destroyed. It was still there in the sky. Roxxon's men all appeared and rushed up around the Doomsday Warrior.
We were blown a mile away somehow.
Rock! We saw the beam go up toward Earth, then stop. Why is the Earth still there? I don't understand.
After a moment, Roxxon let go of Keyloth's throat.
I think Earth is not destroyed because the Neurodancer is more or less a dream becomes reality device. It's the dream that stuff is made of. When Keyloth died, the dream he had of the destruction of Earth died with him.
So, it's over at last. What do we do with Keyloth's body?
Leave it here. This world is for the dead.
With half-gazed looks on their faces, Roxxon and his men headed back toward the saucer, remembering friends, remembering old times. They would not all return from this mission. Some of Earth's finest would forever remain on this tiny world that traveled solo through the lonely universe. It would be their cemetery. It would be theirs forever. A thousand years later, rebirth. The woman stood naked among the fruited trees in the windswept, honey-scented May orchard, her long blonde tresses tossing in the snapping air. She was motionless, as if rooted, yet she was not a tree. She was smooth of flesh and very human despite her tree-like trance. Her arms extended at shoulder height to her sides like tree limbs. Her nude legs were close together. She imagined she was another of the apple trees, that she was a great and powerful apple tree, and the world about her, sunny rolling hills, the tall waving grass, the second growth brush beyond the farm, all agreed. She truly was an apple tree, perhaps the best one on Karak. They accepted her as she was, an apple tree of flesh, and oh how she loved to just stand rooted and silent like the other trees, feeling the sun bringing life through her forehead leaves and down to her wet lips. Down through her throat and chest, through her torso and sturdy legs. She wished she could stay there all night, as well as all day. But she had children. They were waiting down below, in the valley, laughing and playing in the candy song afternoon. They would tire of playing with the others. Her children would call her soon. The last sun rays licked at her toes, those toes that so much wanted to be roots, deep, seeking roots, jutting down to the black source of life.
When I am old, I shall be all gnarled and twisted, and happy to still bear fruit. I will be willing to lose branches in a storm, to be able to look lifeless in the winter, to be able to sprout from all the wrong places on my bark in the summer, leaving the dead branches until midsummer's flickering fire heat to fall off. I will be happy to be among them. I will be a tree someday.
But now she had to tend to her children. She slowly lowered her outstretched arms to her side. She turned her face down into the valley, and her face lost some of its blazing radiance. Slowly she lifted first one root foot and then another. Her slender feet brushed the soft strands of wild grass, swish, swish, as she walked downhill. She became a buxom, naked human woman of bronze skin, of tight torso and precise hips. She was the Pruzak, the ruler of life and death on reborn Karak. They saw her coming. It was always beautiful to watch her descend the hill. They'd accepted her just as another tree when she stood still. But when she moved, they knew her humanity. The people of Karak knew nothing more. For her part, she was aware of their intense, touching stares. The looks caressing the nape of her neck, touching her firm, upturned breasts and pink nipples, sliding up and down her sun-warmed thighs as she began running down the hill. Ah, they thought, what universal rhythms her breasts count out as she runs. What changing, always harmonious, always perfect rhythms. She is beauty itself, they thought, each in his or her way. Why does she want to be a tree? Why does she not bed like other women with men? The tree woman was racing now. She knew where the rocks were hidden in the grass and where they weren't, and she threw herself into the race. She ran faster and faster, as fast as she could. Her children stopped playing and laughed as they saw their mother running. She was so lean and fast, her hair haloed against the descending sun. And then they were swept up by her arms. They laughed in the woman's arms. The tree woman was still running. She slung the children under her arms and continued running through the primitive settlement and out the other side of it. The laughing children knew she was going down to the immense sea to watch for him. The others in the valley, the normal ones, went back to doing what they were doing with their wood and mud, stones and straw. The villagers sighed en masse, thinking that the apple tree woman must eat wild things, but they knew she didn't really have the sun feed her. But on cold, dark days, they'd noticed that she was not so radiant standing up there, and she seemed to grow thinner when the storm clouds lasted all week, darkening the sky. Maybe she was a tree, but the children were normal. There had been one other among them a long time ago who had been as different as the apple tree woman, but he had gone away to the Sea of Death. After years of rolling in the sea at the nearby edge of the world, after years of twisting his body to the contours of the waves and turning his face up toward the sun while his fingers sought out in the sand places only he knew, he was returning. When he had suddenly left one day, no one knew, but they were sad. They liked him, and her. They hoped the woman would stay with them because of the children, and they hoped the children would be like the woman too, for their little normal world needed the woman's wildness. It needed the woman and the man who'd gone away. They were life itself. The apple tree woman felt that the seaman was near. Her body asked for him, so she carried her children to the sea. The ocean gathered its force, and the seaman rolled with it, touching the bottom, got caught in the undertow, and then was thrown up and out of it, cast like jetsam on the shell-littered shore. Scott McCoughlin let it happen, because that's the way he was, yielding. For years, the man had been tossed by the waves. Now he was anxious to stand and yawn and stretch on shore, to leave all the other sea-dead things that roamed mindlessly along the bottoms of the green, dark world of wet. So he lay still in his soaked and algae-green toga, which was a gift of his mentor, who gave him up to this world with a thought. He lay there until the high tide became neck-deep, and then he sat up and opened his eyes, which were caked with salt. He scraped at the eyes of Sea Green with his long yellow fingernails until he could see, and what he saw disturbed him. He found the village was further from the beach than it had been when he left, with lots of orange and tan reptiles digging in the sand right at the pyramid's base. Those reptiles had made pleasing musical noises to indicate their eagerness to meet a mate. Now the beach was deserted, far from the town, yet full of junk, gunk, and worst of all, listless, hungry birds. He saw that the villagers had picked away most of the mussel and mollusks that had come to cover the rocks over eons. The villagers were probably hysterical at the idea that mollusks might eat his eyes, if and when he returned. Maybe it was a kindness. No, he had forsaken the normals for good reason. He had waited for her. She was alien. Something had happened long ago. Something lost. He had walked to the sea then, grabbed and chewed on a seagull, spitting out feathers and swallowing its still trembling heart with savor.
You evil people. I say that there will come a time that even lizards do not like. Therefore, not a good time. I say I will return then.
Now he sensed a presence, and he whipped his sodden, seaweed-filled hair full of snails and rot away from his face and wiped his eyes to see her approach, for he sensed it was her.
I see you, Seaman.
The apple tree woman dropped her children on the soft sand.
I have you, as I have all the lizards, and as I have all the creatures of our once-dead world. I have them all now. But you have eluded me in your wanderings on the ocean floor, in your long absence. Come to me now.
I know you. You are my past.
Yes, and your future. You will join the others within their tombs if you deny me. You will not last in this age. Your time has parted. You must not linger here. Come.
She was beautiful, he thought. But then again, things are always beautiful. She was the sum and substance of all the pasts, or all the lizards and all the sunny days. She was ladies in white taffeta with parasols, Indian maidens and tribal whores, desert flowers, rains and fire of long ago, another place. Yes, she was all that, but the seaman was slow to respond to her the way he previously had. He was too long gone. He pushed himself into the sand while the woman pleaded to him to join her.
Come. It is good to return. Rebirth.
Over 1,000 years would pass yet, until his body was powder, until his nose fell off and was eaten by the mussels, until his final realization. He would yet defeat her through his lack of care for beauty, for only the past is beautiful. And in that time, the bottom creatures would push their heavy black bodies up from the swill of creation, up from his 1,000-year laugh. There really was no time at all, no place for things to go, no need to rush or to regret, nothing at all, except water. Victorious. Only then would he return to her. Then she would come running over the dunes with her children, and he would smile at her. The underwater things would call for him to come, and she would join his world.
You are the primeval, origin of life, Neptune of the sea. You are the muck of creation.
And you are life, vibrant sun, the land reaching up to the stars beyond the sea.
Doomsday Warrior.
America's final defense. Adapted by Johann Detweiler. Directed by Johann Detweiler. Dialogue editing and sound design by Johann Detweiler. Narrated by James Konacek. With performances by David Coyne, James Konacek, Terrence Azelford, James Lewis, Dylan Lynch, Mort Shelby, Michael Raflogel, Tony Penny, Karen Carbone, Christopher Grayville, Lily Beacon, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Richard Rowan, Johan Detweiler, Colleen Delaney, and Michael John Casey. Doomsday Warrior is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1991, Ryder Sievertson. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Doomsday Warrior, be sure to look for Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist and James Axler's Deathlands. Available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
The demon Dactyl came awake. It didn't seem such a momentous thing, just a gradual stirring in a deep cave in a far, empty mountain. An unnoticed event, seen by none save the caveworms and those few insomniacs among the bevy of weary bats hanging from the high ceiling. But the demon's spirit had awakened, had come back from its long dormancy into the statue-like form it had left behind after its last visit to the world called Corona. The tangible, corporeal body felt good to the wandering spirit. The Dactyl could feel its blood, hot blood, coursing through its wings and mighty legs, could feel the twitching of its mighty muscles. Its eyes flickered open, but saw only blackness, for the form, left standing in magical stasis in the deep cave, head bowed and wings wrapped tightly about its torso, had been covered by magma. Most of the fiery stuff of that time long past had bubbled and flowed away from the cavern, but enough had remained to harden about the Dactyl's corporeal form. The spirit had come back to Corona, encased in obsidian. The demon's spirit felt deep within itself, summoned its powers, both physical and magical. By sheer will and brute strength, the Dactyl flexed its wings. A thin crack ran down the center of the obsidian sarcophagus. The Dactyl flexed again. It stretched its great wings out to the side, clawed tips grasping and rending the air. The Dactyl threw back its head and opened wide its mouth. It voiced the sheer joy of its return, the anticipation of the chaos it would bring again to the quiet human kingdoms of Corona. Its torso resembled that of a tall, slender man, shaped and lined by corded strands of taut muscle and sporting a pair of tremendous bat-like wings, 20 feet across when fully extended, and with strength enough to lift a full-grown bull in swift flight. Its head, too, was somewhat human, except more angular, with a narrow jaw and pointed chin. The Dactyl's ears were pointed as well, poking up about the demon creature's thin tuft of black hair. Neither did that hair hide the creature's horns, thumb-sized and curling in toward each other at the top of the demon's brow. The texture of its skin was rough and thick, an armored hide, reddish in hue and shiny, as if lit by its own inner glow. Shining, too, were the demon's eyes, pools of liquid black at most times, but shifting to fiery red orbs, living flames when the demon was agitated, a glow of absolute hatred. The creature flexed and stretched, extended its wings to their full glory, reached and clawed at the air with its human-like arms. The demon extended its fingernails, transformed them into hooked claws, and grew its teeth, two pointed canines extending down over its bottom lip. Every part of the demon was a weapon, devastating and deadly. And yet, this demon's real strength lay in its mind and its purpose, the tempter of souls, the twister of hearts. the maker of lies.
How long has it been? How many decades, centuries have passed since my last visit to Corona?
The creature remembered that long ago time now, savored the thoughts of the streaming blood as army after army had joined in delicious, desperate battle. He saw again the elf who had rallied the humans and the other elves, Terran and Denonial, who chased the Dactyl's armies back to the base of the mountain, Ada. Denonial himself had come into this cave after the beast, had skewered the Dactyl. Yet even in its death throes, the Dactyl had won the day, using its willpower to bring up the magma from the bowels of Ada. Denonial and much of his army had been consumed and destroyed.
I am eternal. I have returned. My physical wounds healed. What man, what elf will take Denonial's place?
Its thoughts turned from its enemies to those it would summon as minions. What creatures could the Dactyl gather this time to wage its war?
The goblins, certainly, full of anger and greed, delighting in murder and war. The Formorian giants of the mountains, few in number, but each with the strength of a dozen men, and a hide too thick and tough for a dagger to puncture. And the Powrys, yes, the Powrys. The cunning, warlike dwarves of the Julianthes, the Weathered Isles, who hate the humans above all others.
A line of drool hung low from the Dactyl's mouth as it considered its former and future allies, its army of woe.
I will bring them into my fold, tribe by tribe, race by race, growing as the night grows when the sun touches the western horizon. Hear me, Corona. Your twilight is at hand. I am awake!
Graphic Audio proudly presents R.A. Salvatore's epic saga, The Demon Wars. Coming soon.
If you can't find that hot Graphic Audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.